This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal land. Former Prime Minister Scott Morrison censured for secretly swearing himself in to several portfolios in the previous government. And the father of a young South Australian man who took his own life calls for the release of a review into mental health services in regional SA.
It is devastating, and you know, at the end of the day, Sally, SA Health, somebody has to tell us who takes responsibility. I haven't given up, and never will, because we need to get answers.
We begin today with federal politics, and it has been an extraordinary morning in Canberra, where the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison has been formally censured by the federal parliament for secretly accruing power and portfolios without even telling his own cabinet, let alone the public. The vote passed 86 to 50. An independent report last week found his actions were unnecessary and corrosive to trust in government. He's the first former Prime Minister to face a censure motion in the House of Representatives and the third in either the House or the Senate. Our National Affairs editor James Glenday has been following proceedings in Canberra. James, good afternoon. The Prime Minister said today was a sad day. Why does he believe this censure motion was necessary?
He said, Sally, that it was necessary because what Mr. Morrison had done was a blatant abuse of good government and of our system of democracy. Mainly, he argued, because the former Prime Minister secretly accrued ministerial powers during a national crisis and then didn't tell everyone what he was doing, or really anyone, which meant that the Parliament and even some of his cabinet colleagues could not hold him to account for the portfolios that he held. Anthony Albanese did acknowledge that much of the former government's record was open to normal political debate, and he said that was right. But he added that this type of power grab, which has stunned, it's got to be said, and angered many of Mr. Morrison's former colleagues, is beyond the pale and should be properly, fully condemned so that it is forever on the former Prime Minister's record.
He owes an apology to the Australian people for the undermining of democracy, and that's why this motion should be supported by every member of this House.
That's Anthony Albanese there. And James Glenday, the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison didn't apologise. How did he justify some of his actions?
It was an extraordinary speech. His justification so far have not really satisfied any of his colleagues. Today's speech was not much different, to be frank. He said, well, I only used these secret powers on one occasion. He said he was being judged in hindsight, which of course, Sally, is the only way he can be judged, because he kept his secret ministry secret. And then he also went on to defend his record in tackling the pandemic. And some of his colleagues think that there was a lot of good that the government did. Crucially, he didn't offer an apology to the parliament or the Australian people.
Mr. Speaker, I acknowledge that the non-disclosure of arrangements has caused unintentional offence and extend an apology to those who were offended. But, Mr. Speaker, I do not apologise for taking action. Had I been asked about these matters at the time at the numerous press conferences I held, I would have responded truthfully about the arrangements I had put in place.
Order.
And we should point out, Sally, that no one had ever secretly accrued power or ministerial portfolios in this way. And so it's not as though any journalist was going to ask, hey, Mr. Morrison, have you secretly made yourself the treasurer or in many other portfolios, for example? And so that kind of explanation doesn't seem to hold a lot of weight. The responsibility, as the independent report into this found, for disclosing these appointments was the Prime Minister's, and he fundamentally undermined the principles of responsible government by not doing so.
James, finally, the opposition opposed this censure motion. Does anyone on his own side think that he did the right thing on Mr. Morrison's side?
With the exception of Mr. Morrison himself, not really. I haven't spoken to anyone who thinks that he did. Quite a lot think that this was very weird. Some think it was deeply sinister. His standing in the Liberal Party has been damaged by this. And one Liberal MP supported the motion, Bridget Archer. She says she thinks that this is a chance for her party to move on from Mr. Morrison.
It would be remiss of me not to mention that for me this issue also sits at the heart of the ability of our party to move forward. This is a clear opportunity for a line to be drawn and to move in the right direction.
And Sally, it did feel as though today might be one of the final speeches that Mr. Morrison will give in the House. I suspect a lot of his colleagues who have stood by him today will now expect him to largely keep his head down and not make Peter Dutton's rebuilding process of the Liberal Party any more difficult.
That's James Glenday in Canberra. A review into the Liberal Party's federal election loss is expected to recommend against the party introducing gender quotas. It will instead opt to implement a British-style recruitment drive to improve the party's gender balance. Members of the Liberal Party say such a strategy is more in line with the organisation's so-called merit-based value system, but not everyone is convinced. Oliver Gordon reports.
Former federal Labor politician turned political academic Mary Crawford was in Parliament when the Labor Party introduced gender quotas in 1994.
It was exciting, it was thrilling, and we believed it would change the nature of politics, and I think to a large extent it has.
For her, the Liberals' moves against adopting quotas are a mistake.
Women make 50% of the population, they're 54% of voters. They want to see themselves represented.
A review into the Morrison government's May election loss has indicated the Liberal Party will opt for a turbocharged recruitment drive over formal quotas. Former moderate Liberal MP Jason Falinski says that's the right approach.
Because it's consistent with Liberal values and principles around these issues.
He says the Liberal Party should replicate what former UK Prime Minister David Cameron did back in 2005.
Effectively, he aggressively went out to attract people, not just more women, but also people from minority groups as well. The most successful part of his program was that he got people from non-traditional professions to join the ranks of the Conservative Party in Westminster.
But when we look to your opposition, the Labor Party, they're doing better when it comes to female representation. For example, if we look at the House, just 9 out of the 48 members in the lower house are female, 11 out of the 27 party senators are female. It's up closer to 50% in the Labor Party. So are they doing it better than you, or is their approach flawed?
Well, mate, I think that the truth of the matter is that they've applied an equality of outcome model. We need to apply an equality of opportunity model.
Falinski lost his seat of McKellar in Sydney's Northern Beaches to Teal independent Sophie Scomps at the last election. He says part of the reason his party's lower house female numbers are low right now is because of the Teal movement.
The billionaire Climate 200 took out a lot of very highly qualified women who were sitting in the House of Representatives.
But he accepts that for the Liberal Party to bring its female numbers back up, any initiative will need to be taken seriously.
We've talked about targets, we've talked about programs, we've never really done it, and it's time for us to actually start implementing some of these things.
It's impossible to determine what impact the party's rejection of gender quotas will have electorally, but Australia Institute Deputy Director Ebony Bennett says polling her organisation undertook before the last federal election indicated it would have played well.
More than half of Australians support the idea of the Liberal Party setting gender quotas. Coalition voters were the most likely of all voters to support the Liberal Party introducing gender quotas. 60% of coalition voters supported that proposition.
The researcher is frank in her assessment of the Liberal Party's decision on this issue.
It's hard to imagine how they can keep trying the same thing and expect different results.
That's the Deputy Director of the Australia Institute, Ebony Bennett, speaking to our reporter, Oliver Gordon. Legislation to establish a National Anti-Corruption Commission has passed both houses of Parliament after years of delays and debate. The previous government promised but failed to deliver the commission. Now, Labor says the body will be up and running by mid-2023. Independent member for Indi, Helen Haynes, has been a long-time campaigner for the establishment of the commission.
This is a mighty step forward. This is historic. The government have delivered on their election promise to establish a federal anti-corruption commission and to indeed legislate it before Christmas. And I think the Australian people know that the crossbench of this parliament pushed both governments, and I'm delighted that we're at this point.
When will this commission be up and running?
My expectation is that it will be up and running sometime around the middle of next year. The Attorney General has said so. He's commenced advertising for the Commissioner positions, and there's money in the budget. So I expect we will see it around the middle of, you know, July onwards.
How will the public get a sense of what's going on when many of the hearings won't be public?
Yes, there's no doubt that I am disappointed that the bar to enable the commissioner to hold public hearings is very high. I certainly argued that we should have public hearings when in the public interest and when there are sufficient safeguards. We will be able to have public hearings, but I think it will be difficult. So, again, we need to see how this progresses.
And the selection of the commissioner, are you happy with the result that has unfolded there with the committee that will appoint that commissioner?
Well, I argued very strongly that there should be greater independence from executive government and the National Anti-Corruption Commission Oversight Committee. As it stands, this committee will be legislated to maintain government control. I think the Albanese government could have done better on this. I didn't win that argument, and so we will have an oversight committee that ultimately has the chair with the casting vote on the decision to appoint the commissioner as nominated by the Attorney General.
In retrospect, should you have pushed harder for that from the beginning?
I don't think I could have pushed any harder. I heard the evidence that was before the inquiry. I thought the evidence was strong to have the oversight made more independent of executive government. The majority of the committee disagreed with me. I then worked through the parliamentary process and put forward amendments in the House of Representatives. They were defeated. And my Senate colleagues tried the same over in the Senate. They were defeated. I'm on the record of saying it could have been better, but ultimately the government has the numbers and the government has made this decision.
Why is it so important for accountability to have this commission?
It's absolutely crucial that when public officials, when members of parliament, when anybody charged with responsibilities of the Commonwealth is seen to do wrong, that is fully tested through a fully independent and powerful anti-corruption commission. This is a very powerful commission, make no mistake about that, and systemic or serious corruption will be investigated. The people of Australia have lost significant trust in Commonwealth government, and I really, really hope now that some of that trust will begin to be restored by having this commission.
That's independent member for Indi, Helen Haynes. Right around Australia, you're listening to The World Today. The family of a young man who died from suicide is demanding the release of a review into mental health resources in rural and regional South Australia. 27-year-old Theo Papagiorgio from South Australia's Riverland took his own life in January 2016. A coronial inquest found that Theo's death was preventable and the mental health system failed to recognise that he was deteriorating. Counsel assisting the coroner found that Theo and his family were essentially cut adrift. In addition to the trauma of the findings, Theo's parents, Jack and Poppy, were left $70,000 out of pocket in legal fees from participating in the inquest. The coroner recommended that SA Health undertake a review of mental health resources in regional SA, but a year later, Jack Papagiorgio is still waiting for the report.
Well, it is disappointing as parents. It is devastating. And, you know, at the end of the day, Sally, SA Health, somebody needs to tell Jack and Poppy who takes responsibility. For God's sake, Theo had a father and he had a mother. I haven't given up and never will, because we need to get answers. So no other family has to go through what we have gone through.
Jack, you and your wife, Poppy, did absolutely everything that you could for your son, Theo, including, you know, staying with him in hospital as much as you could, advocating as much as you could. For other families who might be in a similar situation with a loved one in the mental health system at the moment, what advice would you give to them?
My advice to them, stay, support your children, regardless what they're telling you. I also remind people in the health system that they have a duty of care and you need to stand up, because we've got a system that is failing to our children.
It cost you about $70,000 in legal fees dealing with the coroner's hearings and other things. The coroner very much found that the care for Theo was inadequate, but it cost you a lot of money to participate in that process. Have you had any offers from the state government to give you some financial assistance with the money that you had to spend?
Well, the previous government, we did approach the previous government for some financial support, but the minister declined. So since then, we have met with the new government. We have met twice with the new minister. He has requested his Attorney General to look at their financial support. You know what, Sally? I don't give up that easy. I think we have every right to ask the government of the day to reconsider our financial support, because when we had the inquest, it wasn't about Jack and Poppy. It was about the failure and the cause of death of Thea.
What do you think about the gap in the quality of services between the city and regional areas?
We feel still hurt because the loss of Thea. He did care about his mum and dad and his sister and the people around him. We don't have his love and his hugs anymore. Thea came from a good home and we loved him very much, and he did the same. There's one thing, you know, and he came to a stage in January 2016, and when he started grabbing my hand, kissing it, he kept reminding me, I love you, Dad. Sorry, Dad. I knew. He was waking up in the morning, holding his head, telling me, Dad, the medication is not working. Let me go. Can't do it anymore. That is a serious situation. The minister of the day must act.
That's Jack Papagiorgio, the father of 27-year-old Theo, who took his own life in January 2016. In a statement, the chief psychiatrist, Dr. John Braley, says a team of three reviewers were commissioned to undertake the review, and they've met with the Papagiorgio family, and communication will occur with them when the report is finalised. The review is still underway and will be publicly released following its completion. The full statement will be on our website shortly. And if this story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. The latest report by the Human Rights Commission has found that around one in five Australian workers has been harassed at work in the past 12 months. The fifth national survey on sexual harassment in the workplace has also revealed that a majority of Australian workers has experienced harassment in their lifetime. The Sex Discrimination Commissioner says governments around Australia are taking the right steps to combat the problem, but any real solution will take time. Rachel Mealy reports.
Sexual harassment in Australian workplaces remains rife. Harla worked in a drug and alcohol detox unit where only two staff were rostered on at one time.
The team coordinator there had asked every female colleague out repeatedly. Every time I had to work with him, he would just constantly, for like over an eight-hour shift, make comments about what I'm wearing, how I'm sitting, how much I'm eating, make comments about my body.
She says he made her dread going to work.
I didn't feel comfortable when I'd come to work and see that I had to work with him. I would just brace myself for 8 hours of fighting him off, really, rather than just sort of focusing on what's happening or feeling supported. He was senior in the practice to me.
The Australian Human Rights Commission survey found Harla isn't alone. 9 in 10 Australian women experience sexual harassment at some point in their lifetime. Sarah Charlesworth is Professor Emerita at RMIT University and an expert in gender and employment. She says the statistics remain unchanged.
If one looks just at the prevalence, the overall prevalence of workplace sexual harassment in the last 5 years, it was 33% in 2018. It's still 33% in 2022.
She says a concerning finding of the survey is that reporting of sexual harassment in the workplace remains low.
One gets a bit of a hint from these survey results about why that might be. some people who are asked, the survey asks them why they've experienced sexual harassment, why they haven't reported it. Some people will say it's not serious enough. But a lot of people are saying, for example, that they don't think it'll be taken seriously, or they're concerned about negative repercussions within the workplace.
The most common forms of sexual harassment were sexually suggestive comments or jokes, unwelcome touching or hugging, and inappropriate physical contact. Surprisingly, the COVID years, where many workplaces changed to a work-from-home format, didn't have an impact on the overall incidence of sexual harassment. Professor Charlesworth says the industries with a high prevalence of harassment didn't change to work from home.
Some of the industries, for example, retail, trade and accommodation and food services, they are jobs that you can't do from home. So that we've still got high rates of sexual harassment in the kinds of workplaces where it's face-to-face work, in community services, for example, that is mainly face-to-face.
The Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, says it's unacceptable that so many Australians suffer sexual harassment in their workplace. But she says the recommendations of the federal government's Respect at Work legislation will create a positive duty on all employers to implement measures to prevent sexual harassment.
That report from Rachel Mealy and Rachel Hayter. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. Finally today, around the world, concerns are growing about the threat that microplastics pose, not just to the health of oceans and wildlife, but to humans too. A team of Melbourne researchers thinks they may have the solution to the environmental hazard: a magnetic powder to remove the minuscule bits of plastic from the water. Samantha Donovan has more.
Tiny fragments of plastic known as microplastics are threatening the health of the world's oceans and waterways and their inhabitants. Dr. Mark Anthony Brown from the University of New South Wales is a leading expert on the problem.
We're confronting product that we use in our everyday lives, from our clothing to our packaging. Some of those products can go into the environment and they can break down into smaller pieces. So for microplastics, there's concern really about the impacts they can cause to humans and wildlife. A lot of work has shown, various levels of impact, from inflammatory responses to scar tissue being formed, to changes in how organs work, all the way to mortality in some sort of organisms. And for humans, we're really at the stage whereby there is evidence of inflammatory and scar tissue forming, but we don't really know what happens after that.
Nikki Eshtiaghi is a professor of chemical engineering at RMIT University. She and her team think they've come up with a way to remove tiny microplastics from water. They've developed a magnetic powder that she says does the job in just 1 hour.
We produce it like a carbon-based magnetic powder. When we mix that one with a water which has a microplastic, it absorbs to this adsorbent. And beauty of that one is there is no secondary pollutant left behind because of the magnetic property. We can absorb it by magnet.
Professor Eshtiaghi says now the process has proven successful in the lab, she and her team are hoping water treatment plants and industry will be keen to try it out too.
We really need to be partner with the water utilities in Australia or overseas to be able to take it further a step, to make it work in a real environment.
Dr. Mark Anthony Brown thinks the idea of using a magnetic powder to remove microplastics from water needs further investigation.
I think it's useful preliminary evidence about, a potential method that might work. What we would really need is the technique tested on types of polymers that we know are causing problems in the environment.
And which of those are worrying you the most?
The ones that we're really concerned about are the types of polymers that we find mostly in the environment. These tend to be polyester fibres. The age-old question here is, are they any worse than the natural fibres? And we're really trying to find that out.
Dr. Brown says the best way of stopping tiny fragments of polyester getting into waterways is yet to be worked out.
Do we avoid polyester fibres and switch to natural fibres or another type of plastic? Or do we intercept them with washing machine filters or with improvements to sewage treatment works? or do we re-engineer the actual products themselves to make them more durable so they shed fewer fibres, or do we re-engineer sewage treatment works so that they can catch things more effectively?
That's Dr. Mark Anthony Brown from the University of New South Wales, ending that report from Samantha Donovan. That's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. The PM team will be along later today. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. In the most significant dissent in decades, protesters are taking to the streets across China to vent their frustrations over COVID-19 lockdowns. Today, my colleague, East Asia correspondent Bill Birtles, on how much longer the Chinese leader can hold on to COVID zero. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.